takes to bounce off an obstacle and come back and end up with a good estimate of how far away that obstacle is. It's not all good news. LiDAR can't help with colour or texture. It's hopeless at reading road signs, and it's not great over long distances. Radar, on the other hand, the same idea but with radio waves, does a good job in all sorts of weather conditions, can detect obstacles far away, even seeing through some materials, but is completely hopeless at giving any sort of detail of the shape or structure of the obstacle. On its own, none of these data sources, the camera, the LiDAR, the radar, can do enough to understand what's going on around a vehicle. The trick to successfully building a driverless car is combining them, which would be a relatively easy task if they all agreed about what they're actually seeing, but it's a great deal more difficult when they don't. Consider the tumbleweed that stumped one of the cars in the first DARPA Grand Challenge, and imagine your driverless car finds itself in the same position. The LiDAR is telling you there is an obstacle ahead. The camera agrees. The radar, which can pass through the flimsy tumbleweed, is telling you there's nothing to worry about. Which sensor should your algorithm trust? What if the camera pulls rank? Imagine a big white truck crosses your path on a cloudy day. This time, LiDAR and radar agree that the brakes need to be applied, but against the dull white sky, the camera can see nothing that represents a danger. If that weren't hard enough, there's another problem. You don't just need to worry about your sensors misinterpreting their surroundings. You need to take into account that they might mismeasure them too. You may have noticed that blue circle on Google Maps that surrounds your location. It's there to indicate the potential error in the GPS reading. Sometimes the blue circle will be small and accurately mark your position. At other times, it will cover a much larger area and be centered on entirely the wrong place. Most of the time, it doesn't much matter. We know where we are and we can dismiss incorrect information. But a driverless car doesn't have a ground truth of its position. When it's driving down a single lane of a motorway less than 4 meters wide, it can't rely on GPS alone for an accurate enough diagnosis of where it is. GPS isn't the only reading that's prone to uncertainty. Every measurement taken by the car will have some margin of error. Radar readings, the pitch, the roll, the rotations of the wheels, the inertia of the vehicle, nothing is ever 100% reliable. Plus, different conditions can make things worse. Rain affects LiDAR, glaring sunlight can affect the cameras, and long bumpy drives wreak havoc with accelerometers. In the end, you are left with a big mess of signals. Questions that seemed simple. Where are you? What's around you? What should you do? Become staggeringly difficult to answer. It's almost impossible to know what to believe. Almost impossible, but not quite. Because thankfully, there is a route through all of this chaos, a way to make sensible guesses in a messy world. It all comes down to a phenomenally powerful mathematical formula known as Bayes' theorem. The Great Church of the Reverend Bayes. It's no exaggeration to say that Bayes' theorem is one of the most influential ideas in history. Among scientists, machine learning experts, and statisticians, it commands an almost cultish enthusiasm. Yet at its heart, the idea is extraordinarily simple. So simple, in fact, that you might initially think it's just stating the obvious. Let me try and illustrate the idea with a particularly trivial example. Imagine you're having dinner in a restaurant. At some point during the meal, your companion leans over and whispers that they've spotted Lady Gaga eating at the table opposite. Before having a look for yourself, you'll no doubt have some sense of how much you believe your friend's theory. You'll take into account all of your prior knowledge, perhaps the quality of the establishment, the distance you are from Gaga's home in Malibu, your friend's eyesight, that sort of thing. If pushed, it's a belief that you could put a number on, a probability of sorts. As you turn to look at the woman, you'll automatically use each piece of evidence in front of you to update your belief in your friend's hypothesis. Perhaps the platinum blonde hair is consistent with what you would expect from Gaga, so your belief goes up. But the fact that she's sitting down on her own with no bodyguards isn't, so your belief goes down. The point is, each new observation adds to your overall assessment. This is all Bayes' theorem does, offers a systematic way to update your belief in a hypothesis on the basis of the evidence. It accepts that you can't ever be completely certain about the theory you're considering, but allows you to make a best guess from the information available. So once you realize the woman at the table opposite is wearing a dress made of meat, a fashion choice that you're unlikely to chance upon in the non-Gaga population, that might be enough to tip your belief over the threshold and lead you to conclude that it is indeed Lady Gaga in the restaurant. But Bayes' theorem isn't just an equation for the way humans already make decisions. It's much more important than that. To quote Sharon Birch McGrain, author of The Theory That Would Not Die, Bayes runs counter to the deeply held conviction that modern science requires objectivity and precision. By providing a mechanism to measure your belief in something, Bayes allows you to draw sensible conclusions from sketchy observations, from messy, incomplete, and approximate data, even from ignorance. Bayes isn't just there to confirm your existing intuitions. It turns out that being forced to quantify your beliefs in something often leads to counterintuitive conclusions. It's Bayes' theorem that explains why more men than women are falsely identified as future murderers in the example from the Justice chapter. And it's Bayes' theorem that explains why, even if you've been diagnosed with breast cancer, the level of error in the tests means you probably don't have it, as we encountered in the medicine chapter. Across all branches of science, Bayes is a powerful tool for distilling and understanding what we really know. But where the Bayesian way of thinking really comes into its own is when you're trying to consider more than one hypothesis simultaneously. For example, in attempting to diagnose what's wrong with a patient on the basis of their symptoms, or finding the position of a driverless car on the basis of sensor readings. In theory, any disease, any point on the map, could represent the underlying truth. All you need to do is weigh up the evidence and decide which is most likely to be right. And on that point, finding the location of a driverless car turns out to be rather similar to a problem that puzzled Thomas Bayes, the British Presbyterian minister and talented mathematician after whom the theorem is named. Back in the mid-1700s, he wrote an essay which included details of a game he'd devised to explain the problem. It went something a little like this. Imagine you're sitting with your back to a square table. Without you seeing, I throw a red ball onto the table. Your job is to guess where it landed. It's not going to be easy, with no information to go on. There's no real way of knowing where on the table it could be. So to help your guess, I throw a second ball of a different colour onto the same table. Your job is still to determine the location of the first ball, the red one, but this time I'll tell you where the second ball ends up on the table relative to the first, whether it's in front, behind, to the left or right of the red ball. And you get to update your guess. Then we repeat. I throw a third, a fourth, a fifth ball onto the table, and every time I'll tell you where each one lands relative to the very first red one, the one whose position you're trying to guess. The more balls I throw and the more information I give you, the clearer the picture of the red ball's position should become in your mind. You'll never be absolutely sure of exactly where it sits, but you can keep updating your belief about its position until you end up with an answer you're confident in. In some sense, the true position of the driverless car is analogous to that of the red ball. Instead of a person sitting with their back to the table, there's an algorithm trying to gauge exactly where the car is at that moment in time. And instead of other balls thrown onto the table, there are the data sources, the GPS, the inertial measurements, and so on. None of them tell the algorithm where the car is, but each adds a little bit more information the algorithm can use to update its belief. It's a trick known as probabilistic inference, using the data, plus Bayes, to infer the true position of the object. Packaged up correctly, it's just another kind of machine learning algorithm. By the turn of the millennium, engineers had had enough practice with cruise missiles, rocket ships, and aircraft to know how to tackle the position problem. Getting a driverless car to answer the question, "Where am I?" still wasn't trivial, but with a bit of Bayesian thinking, it was at least achievable. Between the robot graveyard of the 2004 Grand Challenge and the awe-inspiring technological triumph of the 2005 event, when five different vehicles managed to race more than 100 miles without any human input, many of the biggest leaps forward were thanks to Bayes. It was algorithms based on Bayesian ideas that helped solve the other questions the car needed to answer. What's around me and what should I do? So should your driverless car hit a pedestrian to save your life? Let's pause for a moment to consider the second of those questions, because on this very topic in early autumn 2006, tucked away in a quiet corner of an otherwise bustling exhibition hall at the Paris Auto Show, a Mercedes-Benz spokesperson made a rather exceptional statement. Christoph von Hugo, the manager of driver assistance systems and active safety for the company, was asked in an interview what a driverless Mercedes might do in a crash. "If you know you can save at least one person, at least save that one," he replied. Sensible logic, you would think, hardly headline news. Except Hugo wasn't being asked about any old crash. He was being tested on his response to a well-worn thought experiment dating back to the 1960s, involving a very particular kind of collision. The interviewer was asking him about a curious conundrum that forces a choice between two evils. It's known as the trolley problem, after the runaway tram that was the subject of the original formulation. In the case of driverless cars, it goes a little something like this. Imagine some years into the future, you're a passenger in an autonomous vehicle, happily driving along a city street. Ahead of you, a traffic light turns red, but a mechanical failure in your car means you're unable to stop. A collision is inevitable, but your car has a choice. Should it swerve off the road into a concrete wall, causing certain death to anyone inside the vehicle? Or should it carry on going, saving the lives of anyone inside, but killing the pedestrians now crossing the road? What should the car be programmed to do? How do you decide who should die? No doubt you have your own opinion. Perhaps you think the car should simply try and save as many lives as possible. Or perhaps you think that thou shalt not kill should override any calculations, leaving the one sitting in the machine to bear the consequences. Hugo was clear about the Mercedes position. "Save the one in the car," he went on. "If all you know for sure is that one death can be prevented, then that's your first priority." In the days following the interview, the internet was awash with articles berating Mercedes' stance. Their cars will act much like the stereotypical entitled European luxury car driver, wrote the author of one piece. Indeed, in a survey published in Science that very summer, 76% of respondents felt it would be more moral for driverless cars to save as many lives as possible, thus killing the people in the car. Mercedes had come down on the wrong side of popular opinion. Or had they? Because when the same study asked participants if they would actually buy a car which would murder them if the circumstances arose, they suddenly seemed reluctant to sacrifice themselves for the greater good. This is a conundrum that divides opinion, and not just in what people think the answer should be. As a thought experiment, it remains a firm favourite of technology reporters and other journalists, but all the driverless car experts I interviewed rolled their eyes as soon as the trolley problem was mentioned. Personally, I still have a soft spot for it. Its simplicity forces us to recognize something important about driverless cars, to challenge how we feel about an algorithm making a value judgment on our own and others' lives. At the heart of this new technology, as with almost all algorithms, are questions about power, expectation, control and delegation of responsibility, and about whether we can expect our technology to fit in with us rather than the other way around. But I'm also sympathetic to the aloof reaction that it receives in the driverless car community. They, more than anyone, know how far away we are from having to worry about the trolley problem as a reality. Breaking the rules of the road. Bayes' theorem and the power of probability have driven much of the innovation in autonomous vehicles ever since the DARPA challenge. I asked Paul Newman, professor of robotics at the University of Oxford and founder of Oxbotica, a company that builds driverless cars and tests them on the streets of Britain, how his latest autonomous vehicles worked, and he explained as follows. It's many, many millions of lines of code, but I could frame the entire thing as probabilistic inference, all of it. But while Bayesian inference goes some way to explaining how driverless cars are possible, it also explains how full autonomy, free from any input by a human driver, is a very, very difficult nut to crack. Imagine, Paul Newman suggests, you've got two vehicles approaching each other at speed, say travelling in different directions down a gently curved A road. A human driver will be perfectly comfortable in that scenario, knowing that the other car will stick to its own lane and pass safely a couple of metres to the side. But for the longest time, Newman explains, it does look like you're going to hit each other. How do you teach a driverless car not to panic in that situation? You don't want the vehicle to drive off the side of the road, trying to avoid a collision that was never going to happen. But equally, you don't want it to be complacent if you really do find yourself on the verge of a head-on crash. Remember too, these cars are only ever making educated guesses about what to do. How do you get it to guess right every single time? That, says Newman, is a hard, hard problem. It's a problem that puzzled the experts for a long time, but it does have a solution. The trick is to build in a model for how other sane drivers will behave. Unfortunately, the same can't be said of other nuanced driving scenarios. Newman explains, what's hard is all the problems with driving that have nothing to do with driving. For instance, teaching an algorithm to understand that hearing the tunes of an ice cream van or passing a group of kids playing with a ball on the pavement might mean you need to be extra cautious. Or to recognise the confusing hopping of a kangaroo, which, at the time of writing, Volvo admitted to be struggling with. Probably not much of a problem if you're in rural Surrey, but something the cars need to master if they're going to be roadworthy in Australia. Even harder, how do you teach a car that it should sometimes break the rules of the road? What if you are sitting at a red light and someone runs in front of your car and frantically beckons you to edge forwards? Or if an ambulance with its lights on is trying to get past on a narrow street and you need to mount the pavement to let it through? Or if an oil tanker has jackknifed across a country lane and you need to get out of there by any means possible? None of these are in the highway code, Newman rightly points out. And yet a truly autonomous car needs to know how to deal with all of them if it's to exist without ever having any human intervention, even in emergencies. That's not to say these are insurmountable problems. I don't believe there's any level of intelligence that we won't be able to get a machine to, Newman told me. The only question is when. Unfortunately, the answer to that question is probably not anytime soon. That driverless dream we're all waiting for might be quite a lot further away than we think, because there's another layer of difficulty to contend with when trying to build that sci-fi fantasy of a go-anywhere, do-anything, steering wheel-free driverless car, and it's one that goes well beyond the technical challenge. A fully autonomous car will also have to deal with the tricky problem of people. Jack Stilgo, a sociologist from University College London and an expert in the social impacts of technology, explains, people are mischievous. They're active agents, not just passive parts of the scenery. Imagine for a moment a world where truly perfectly autonomous vehicles exist. The number one rule in their onboard algorithms will be to avoid collisions wherever possible. And that changes the dynamics of the road. If you stand in front of a driverless car, it has to stop. If you pull out in front of one at a junction, it has to behave submissively. In the words of one participant at a 2016 focus group at the London School of Economics, you're going to mug them right off. They're going to stop and you're just going to nip round. Translation, these cars can be bullied. Stilgo agrees. People who've been relatively powerless on roads up until now, like cyclists, may start cycling very slowly in front of self-driving cars, knowing that there is never going to be any aggression. Getting around this problem might mean bringing in stricter rules to deal with people who abuse their position as cyclists or pedestrians. It's been done before, of course. Think of jaywalking. Or it could mean forcing everybody else off the roads, as happened with the introduction of the motor car. Which is already why you don't see bicycles, horses, carts, carriages, or pedestrians on a motorway. If we want fully autonomous cars, we'll almost certainly have to do something similar again and limit the number of aggressive drivers, ice cream vans, kids playing in the road, roadwork signs, difficult pedestrians, emergency vehicles, cyclists, mobility scooters, and everything else that makes the problem of autonomy so difficult. That's fine, but it's a little different from the way the idea is currently being sold to us. The rhetoric of autonomy and transport is all about not changing the world, Stilgo tells me. It's about keeping the world as it is, but making and allowing a robot to just be as good as and then better than a human at navigating it. And I think that's stupid. But hang on, some of you may be thinking. Hasn't this problem already been cracked? Hasn't Waymo, Google's autonomous car, driven millions of miles already? Aren't Waymo's fully autonomous cars, or at least close to fully autonomous, currently driving on the roads of Phoenix, Arizona? Well, yes, that's true. But not every mile of road is created equally. Most miles are so easy to drive you can do it while daydreaming. Others are far more challenging. At the time of writing, Waymo cars aren't allowed to go just anywhere. They are geo-fenced into a small, predefined area. So too are the driverless cars Daimler and Ford propose to have on the roads by 2020 and 2021, respectively. They're ride-hailing cars confined to a pre-decided go zone. And that does make the problem of autonomy quite a lot simpler. Paul Newman thinks this is the future of driverless cars we can expect. They'll come out working in an area that's very well known, where their owners are extremely confident that they'll work. So it could be part of a city, not in the middle of a place with unusual roads or where cows could wander into the path. Maybe they'll work at certain times of the day and in certain weather situations. They're going to be operated as a transport service. That's not quite the same thing as full autonomy. Here's Jack Stilgo's take on the necessary compromise. Things that look like autonomous systems are actually systems in which the world is constrained to make them look autonomous. The vision we've come to believe in is like a trick of the light, a mirage that promises luxurious private chauffeur for all, but close up is actually just a local minibus. If you still need persuading, I'll leave the final word on the matter to one of America's biggest automotive magazines, Car and Driver. No car company actually expects the futuristic, crash-free utopia of streets packed with driverless vehicles to transpire anytime soon, nor for decades. But they do want to be taken seriously by Wall Street, as well as stir up the imaginations of a public increasingly disinterested in driving. And in the meantime, they hope to sell lots of vehicles with the latest sophisticated driver assistance technology. So how about that driver assistance technology? After all, driverless cars are not an all-or-nothing proposition. Driverless technology is categorized using six different levels, from level zero, no automation whatsoever, up to level five, the fully autonomous fantasy. In between, they range from cruise control, level two, to geo-fenced autonomous vehicles, level four, and are colloquially referred to as level one, feet off, level two, hands off, level three, eyes off, level four, brain off. So maybe level five isn't on our immediate horizon and level four won't be quite what it's cracked up to be, but there's a whole lot of automation to be had on the way up. What's wrong with just slowly working up the levels in our private cars? Build cars with steering wheels and brake pedals and drivers in driver's seats and just allow a human to step in and take over in an emergency. Surely that'll do until the technology improves. Unfortunately, things aren't quite that simple, because there's one last twist in the tale, a whole host of other problems, an inevitable obstacle for anything short of total human-free driving. The company baby. Among the pilots at Air France, Pierre Cédric Bonin was known as a company baby. He had joined the airline at the tender age of 26, with only a few hundred hours of flying time under his belt, and had grown up in the airline's fleet of Airbuses. By the time he stepped aboard the fated flight of AF447 aged 32, he had managed to clock up a respectable 2,936 hours in the air, although that still made him by far the least experienced of the three pilots on board. Nonetheless, it was Bonin who sat at the controls of Air France Flight 447 on the 31st of May 2009 as it took off from the tarmac of Rio de Janeiro Galeão International Airport and headed home to Paris. This was an Airbus A330, one of the most sophisticated commercial aircraft ever built. Its autopilot system was so advanced that it was practically capable of completing an entire flight unaided, apart from takeoff and landing. And even when the pilot was in control, it had a variety of built-in safety features to minimize the risk of human error. But there's a hidden danger in building an automated system that can safely handle virtually every issue its designers can anticipate. If a pilot is only expected to take over in exceptional circumstances, they'll no longer maintain the skills they need to operate the system themselves, so they'll have very little experience to draw on to meet the challenge of an unanticipated emergency. And that's what happened with Air France Flight 447. Although Bonin had accumulated thousands of hours in an Airbus cockpit, his actual experience of flying an A330 by hand was minimal. His role as a pilot had mostly been to monitor the automatic system. It meant that when the autopilot disengaged during that evening's flight, Bonin didn't know how to fly the plane safely. The trouble started when ice crystals began to form inside the airspeed sensors built into the fuselage. Unable to take a sensible reading, the autopilot sounded an alarm in the cabin and passed responsibility to the human crew. This in itself was not cause for concern, but when the plane hit a small bump of turbulence, the inexperienced Bonin overreacted. As the aircraft began to roll gently to the right, Bonin grabbed the side stick and pulled it to the left. Crucially, at the same time, he pulled back on the stick, sending the aircraft into a dramatically steep climb. As the air thinned around the plane, Bonin kept tightly pulling back on the stick until the nose of the aircraft was so high that the air could no longer flow slickly over the wings. The wings effectively became windbreakers, and the aircraft dramatically lost lift, free-falling, nose up, out of the sky. Alarms sounded in the cockpit. The captain burst back in from the rest cabin. AF447 was descending towards the ocean at 10,000 feet per minute. By now, the ice crystals had melted, there was no mechanical malfunction, and the ocean was far enough below them that they could still recover in time. Bonin and his co-pilot could have easily rescued everyone on board in just 10 to 15 seconds, simply by pushing the stick forward, dropping the aircraft's nose, and allowing the air to cleanly rush over the wings again. But in his panic, Bonin kept the side stick pulled back. No one realized he was the one causing the issue. Precious seconds ticked by. The captain suggested leveling the wings. They briefly discussed whether they were ascending or descending. Then, within 8,000 feet of sea level, the co-pilot took the controls. "Climb, climb, climb," the co-pilot is heard shouting. "But I've had the stick back the whole time," Bonin replied. The penny dropped for the captain. He finally realized they had been free-falling in aerodynamic stall for more than 3 minutes and ordered them to drop the nose. Too late. Tragically, by now, they were too close to the surface. Bonin screamed, "Damn it! We're going to crash! This can't be happening!" Moments later, the aircraft plunged into the Atlantic, killing all 228 souls on board. Ironies of automation. 26 years before the Air France crash, in 1983, the psychologist Lizanne Bainbridge wrote a seminal essay on the hidden dangers of relying too heavily on automated systems. "Build a machine to improve human performance," she explained, "and it will lead, ironically, to a reduction in human ability." By now, we've all borne witness to this in some way. It's why people can't remember phone numbers anymore, why many of us struggle to read our own handwriting, and why lots of us can't navigate anywhere without GPS. With technology to do it all for us, there's little opportunity to practice our skills. There is some concern that the same might happen with self-driving cars, where the stakes are a lot higher than with handwriting. Until we get to full autonomy, the car will still sometimes unexpectedly hand back control to the driver. Will we be able to remember instinctively what to do? And will teenage drivers of the future ever have the chance to master the requisite skills in the first place? But even if all drivers manage to stay competent, allowing for generous interpretation of the word stay, there's another issue we'll still have to contend with, because what the human driver is asked to do before autopilot cuts out is also important. There are only two possibilities, and as Bainbridge points out, neither is particularly appealing. A level two car, that's hands off, will expect the driver to pay careful attention to the road at all times. It's not good enough to be trusted on its own and will need your careful supervision. Wired once described this level as like getting a toddler to help you with the dishes. At the time of writing, Tesla's autopilot is one such example of this approach. It's currently like a fancy cruise control. It'll steer and brake and accelerate on the motorway, but expects the driver to be alert and attentive and ready to step in at all times. To make sure you're paying attention, an alarm will sound if you remove your hands from the wheel for too long. But, as Bainbridge wrote in her essay, that's not an approach that's going to end well. It's just unrealistic to expect humans to be vigilant. It's impossible for even a highly motivated human to maintain effective visual attention towards a source of information on which very little happens for more than about half an hour. There's some evidence that people have struggled to heed Tesla's insistence that they keep their attention on the road. Joshua Brown, who died at the wheel of his Tesla in 2016, had been using autopilot mode for 37 and a half minutes when his car hit a truck that was crossing his lane. The investigation by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration concluded that Brown had not been looking at the road at the time of the crash. The accident was headline news around the world, but this hasn't stopped some foolhardy YouTubers from posting videos enthusiastically showing how to trick your car into thinking you're paying attention. Supposedly, taping a can of Red Bull or wedging an orange into the steering wheel will stop the car setting off those pesky alarms reminding you of your responsibilities. Other programs are finding the same issue. Although Uber's driverless cars need human intervention every 13 miles, getting drivers to pay attention remains a struggle. On the 18th of March 2018, an Uber self-driving vehicle fatally struck a pedestrian. Video footage from inside the car showed that the human monitor sitting behind the wheel was looking away from the road in the moments before the collision. This is a serious problem, but there is an alternative option. The car companies could accept that humans will be humans and acknowledge that our minds will wander. After all, being able to read a book while driving is part of the appeal of self-driving cars. This is the key difference between level 2, hands off, and level 3, eyes off. The latter certainly presents more of a technical challenge than level two, but some manufacturers have already started to build their cars to accommodate our inattention. Audi's traffic jam pilot is one such example. It can completely take over when you're in slow-moving highway traffic, leaving you to sit back and enjoy the ride. Just be prepared to step in if something goes wrong. There's a reason why Audi has limited its system to slow-moving traffic on limited access roads. The risks of catastrophe are lower in motorway congestion, and that's important. Because as soon as a human stops monitoring the road, you're left with the worst possible combination of circumstances when an emergency happens. A driver who's not paying attention will have very little time to assess their surroundings and decide what to do. Imagine sitting in a self-driving car, hearing an alarm, and looking up from your book to see a truck ahead shedding its load into your path. In an instant, you'll have to process all the information around you, the motorbike in the left lane, the van braking hard ahead, the car in the blind spot on your right. You'd be most unfamiliar with the road at precisely the moment you need to know it best. Add in the lack of practice and you'll be as poorly equipped as you could be to deal with the situations demanding the highest level of skill. It's a fact that has also been borne out in experiments with driverless car simulations. One study, which let people read a book or play on their phones while the car drove itself, found that it took up to 40 seconds after an alarm sounded for them to regain proper control of the vehicle. That's exactly what happened with Air France Flight 447. Captain Dubois, who should have been easily capable of saving the plane, took around 1 minute too long to realize what was happening and come up with the simple solution that would have solved the problem. Ironically, the better self-driving technology gets, the worse these problems become. A sloppy autopilot that sets off an alarm every 15 minutes will keep a driver continually engaged and in regular practice. It's the smooth and sophisticated automatic systems that are almost always reliable that you've got to watch out for. This is why Gil Pratt, who heads up Toyota's research institute, has said, "The worst case is a car that will need driver intervention once every 200,000 miles. An ordinary person who has a new car every 100,000 miles would never see it. The automation handover control, that is. But every once in a while, maybe once for every two cars that I own, there would be that one time where it suddenly goes, beep, 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 now it's your turn. And the person, typically not having seen this for years and years, would not be prepared when that happened." Great expectations. Despite all this, there's good reason to push ahead into the self-driving future. The good still outweighs the bad. Driving remains one of the biggest causes of avoidable deaths in the world. If the technology is remotely capable of reducing the number of fatalities on the roads overall, you could argue that it would be unethical not to roll it out. And there's no shortage of other advantages. Even simple driving aids can reduce fuel consumption and ease traffic congestion. Plus, let's be honest, the idea of taking your hands off the steering wheel while doing 70 miles an hour, even if it's only for a moment, is just cool. But thinking back to Bainbridge's warnings, they do hint at a problem with how self-driving technology is being framed. Take Tesla, one of the first car manufacturers to bring an autopilot to the market. There's little doubt that their system has had a net positive impact, making driving safer for those who use it. You don't need to look far to find online videos of the forward collision warning feature, recognizing the risk of accident before the driver, setting off an alarm and saving the car from crashing. But there's a slight mismatch between what the cars can do with what's essentially a fancy forward-facing parking sensor and clever cruise control, and the language used to describe them. For instance, in October 2016, the company announced that all Tesla cars being produced now have full self-driving hardware. At the time of writing this in February 2018, the full self-driving hardware is an optional extra that can be paid for at purchase, although the car is not currently running the software to complete full self-driving trips. The Tesla website says it's not possible to know exactly when each element of the functionality described above will be available. But there's more. According to an article in The Verge, Elon Musk, product architect of Tesla, added, "The full autonomy update will be standard on all Tesla vehicles from here on out." And that phrase, full autonomy, is arguably at odds with the warning users must accept before using the current autopilot. You need to maintain control and responsibility of your vehicle. Expectations are important. You may disagree, but I think that people shoving oranges in their steering wheels, or worse, as I found in the darker corners of the web, creating and selling devices that allow early adopters to drive while reducing or turning off the autopilot check-in warning, is the inevitable corollary of a trusted brand using language that misleads. Of course, Tesla isn't the only culprit in the car industry, and every company on earth appeals to our fantasies to buy their products. But for me, there's a difference between buying a perfume because I think it will make me more attractive and buying a car because I think its full autonomy will keep me safe. Marketing strategies aside, I can't help but wonder if we're thinking about driverless cars in the wrong way altogether. By now, we know that humans are really good at understanding subtleties, at analyzing context, applying experience, and distinguishing patterns. We're really bad at paying attention, at precision, at consistency, and at being fully aware of our surroundings. We have, in short, precisely the opposite set of skills to algorithms. So why not follow the lead of the tumor-finding software in the medical world and let the skills of the machine complement the skills of the human and advance the abilities of both? Until we get to full autonomy, why not flip the equation on its head and aim for a self-driving system that supports the driver rather than the other way around? A safety net like ABS or traction control that can patiently monitor the road and stay alert for a danger the driver has missed. Not so much a chauffeur as a guardian. That is the idea behind work being done by the Toyota Research Institute. They're building two modes into their car. There's the chauffeur mode, which, like Audi's traffic jam pilot, could take over in heavy congestion. And there's the guardian mode, which runs in the background while a human drives and acts as a safety net, reducing the risk of an accident if anything crops up the driver hasn't seen. Volvo has adopted a similar approach. Its autonomous emergency braking system, which automatically slows the car down if it gets too close to a vehicle in front, is widely credited for the impressive safety record of the Volvo XC90. Since the car first went on sale in the UK in 2002, over 50,000 vehicles have been purchased, and not a single driver or passenger within any of them has been killed in a crash. Like much of the driverless technology that is so keenly discussed, we'll have to wait and see how this turns out. But one thing is for sure, as time goes on, autonomous driving will have a few lessons to teach us that apply well beyond the world of motoring. Not just about the messiness of handing over control, but about being realistic in our expectations of what algorithms can do. If this is going to work, we'll have to adjust our way of thinking. We're going to need to throw away the idea that cars should work perfectly every time and accept that, while mechanical failure might be a rare event, algorithmic failure almost certainly won't be anytime soon. So knowing that errors are inevitable, knowing that if we proceed, we have no choice but to embrace uncertainty, the conundrums within the world of driverless cars will force us to decide how good something needs to be before we're willing to let it loose on our streets. That is an important question, and it applies elsewhere. How good is good enough? Once you've built a flawed algorithm that can calculate something, should you let it? Chapter 6, Crime. It was a warm July day in 1995 when a 22-year-old university student packed up her books, left the Leeds Library and headed back to her car. She'd spent the day putting the finishing touches to her dissertation, and now she was free to enjoy the rest of her summer. But as she sat in the front seat of her car, getting ready to leave, she heard the sound of someone running through the multi-story car park towards her. Before she had a chance to react, a man leaned in through the open window and held a knife to her throat. He forced her onto the back seat, tied her up, superglued her eyelids together, took the wheel of the car, and drove away. After a terrifying drive, he pulled up at a grassy embankment. She heard a clunk as he dropped his seat down, and then a shuffling as he started undoing his clothes. She knew he was intending to rape her. Fighting blind, she pulled her knees up to her chest and pushed outwards with all her might, forcing him backwards. As she kicked and struggled, the knife in his hand cut into his fingers and his blood dripped onto the seats. He hit her twice in the face, but then to her immense relief, got out of the car and left. 2 hours after her ordeal had begun, the student was found wandering down Globe Road in Leeds, distraught and dishevelled, her shirt torn, her face red from where he'd struck her, and her eyelids sealed with glue. Sexual attacks on strangers like this one are incredibly rare, but when they do occur, they tend to form part of a series. And sure enough, this wasn't the first time the same man had struck. When police analysed blood from the car, they found its DNA matched a sample from a rape carried out in another multi-storey car park 2 years earlier. That attack had taken place some 100 kilometres further south, in Nottingham. And after an appeal on the BBC Crime Watch programme, police also managed to link the case to 3 other incidents a decade before in Bradford, Leeds and Leicester. But tracking down this particular serial rapist was not going to be easy. Together, these crimes spanned an area of 7,046 square kilometres, an enormous stretch of the country. They also presented the police with a staggering number of potential suspects, 33,628 in total, each one of whom would have to be eliminated from their inquiries or investigated. An enormous search would have to be made, and not for the first time. The attacks 10 years earlier had led to a massive manhunt, but despite knocking on 14,153 doors and collecting numerous swabs, hair samples and all sorts of other evidence, the police investigation had eventually led nowhere. There was a serious risk that the latest search would follow the same path, until a Canadian ex-cop, Kim Rossmo, and his newly developed algorithm were brought in to help. Rossmo had a bold idea. Rather than taking into account the vast amount of evidence already collected, his algorithm would ignore virtually everything. Instead, it would focus its attention exclusively on a single factor, geography. Perhaps, said Rossmo, a perpetrator doesn't randomly choose where they target their victims. Perhaps their choice of location isn't an entirely free or conscious decision. Even though these attacks had taken place up and down the country, Rossmo wondered if there could be an unintended pattern hiding in the geography of the crimes, a pattern simple enough to be exploited. There was a chance, he believed, that the locations at which crimes took place could betray where the criminal actually came from. The case of the serial rapist was a chance to put his theory to the test. Operation Lynx and the Lawn Sprinkler. Rossmo wasn't the first person to suggest that criminals unwittingly create geographical patterns. His ideas have a lineage that dates back to the 1820s when André Michel Guéry, a lawyer turned statistician who worked for the French Ministry of Justice, started collecting records on the rapes, murders and robberies that occurred in the various regions of France. Although collecting these kinds of numbers seems like a fairly standard thing to do now, at the time, maths and statistics had only ever been applied to the hard sciences, where equations are used to elegantly describe the physical laws of the universe, tracing the path of a planet across the sky, calculating the forces within a steam engine, that sort of thing. No one had bothered to collect crime data before. No one had any idea what to count, how to count, or how often they should count it. And anyway, people thought at the time, what was the point? Man was strong, independent in nature, and wandering around, acting according to his own free will. His behaviour couldn't possibly be captured by the paltry practice of statistics. But Gehry's analysis of his national census of criminals suggested otherwise. No matter where you were in France, he found, recognisable patterns appeared in what crimes were committed, how, and by whom. Young people committed more crimes than old, men more than women, poor more than rich. Intriguingly, it soon became clear that these patterns didn't change over time. Each region had its own set of crime statistics that would barely change year on year. With an almost terrifying exactitude, the numbers of robberies, rapes and murders would repeat themselves from one year to the next, and even the methods used by the murderers were predictable. This meant that Guerry and his colleagues could pick an area and tell you in advance exactly how many murders by knife, sword, stone, strangulation or drowning you could expect in a given year. So maybe it wasn't a question of the criminal's free will after all. Crime is not random. People are predictable. And it was precisely that predictability that, almost two centuries after Guerry's discovery, Kim Rossmo wanted to exploit. Guerry's work focused on the patterns found at the country and regional levels, but even at the individual level, it turns out that people committing crime still create reliable geographical patterns. Just like the rest of us, criminals tend to stick to areas they are familiar with. They operate locally. That means that even the most serious of crimes will probably be carried out close to where the offender lives. And as you move further and further away from the scene of the crime, the chance of finding your perpetrator's home slowly drops away, an effect known to criminologists as distance decay. On the other hand, serial offenders are unlikely to target victims who live very close by to avoid unnecessary police attention on their doorsteps or being recognised by neighbours. The result is known as a buffer zone, which encircles the offender's home, a region in which there'll be a very low chance of their committing a crime. These two key patterns, distance decay and the buffer zone, hidden among the geography of the most serious crimes, were at the heart of Rossmo's algorithm. Starting with a crime scene pinned onto a map, Rossmo realised he could mathematically balance these two factors and sketch out a picture of where the perpetrator might live. That picture isn't especially helpful when only one crime has been committed. Without enough information to go on, the so-called geo-profiling algorithm won't tell you much more than good old-fashioned common sense. But as more crimes are added, the picture starts to sharpen, slowly bringing into focus a map of the city that highlights areas in which you're most likely to catch your culprit. It's as if the serial offender is a rotating lawn sprinkler. Just as it would be difficult to predict where the very next drop of water is going to fall, you can't foresee where your criminal will attack next. But once the water has been spraying for a while and many drops have fallen, it's relatively easy to observe from the pattern of the drops where the lawn sprinkler is likely to be situated. And so it was with Rossmo's algorithm for Operation Lynx, the hunt for the serial rapist. The team now had the locations of five separate crimes, plus several places where a stolen credit card had been used by the attacker to buy alcohol, cigarettes, and a video game. On the basis of just those locations, the algorithm highlighted two key areas in which it believed the perpetrator was likely to live, Millgarth and Killingbeck, both in the suburbs of Leeds. Back in the incident room, police had one other key piece of evidence to go on, a partial fingerprint left by the attacker at the scene of an earlier crime. It was too small a sample for an automatic fingerprint recognition system to be able to whiz through a database of convicted criminals' prints looking for a match, so any comparisons would need to be made meticulously by an expert with a magnifying glass, painstakingly examining one suspect at a time. By now, the operation was almost 3 years old, and despite the best efforts of 180 different officers from 5 different forces, it was beginning to run out of steam. Every lead resulted in just another dead end. Officers decided to manually check all the fingerprints recorded in the 2 places the algorithm had highlighted. First up was Milgarth, but a search through the prints stored in the local police database returned nothing. Then came Killingbeck, and after 940 hours of sifting through the records here, the police finally came up with a name, Clive Barwell. Barwell was a 42-year-old married man and father of 4 who had been in jail for armed robbery during the hiatus in the attacks. He now worked as a lorry driver and would regularly make long trips up and down the country in the course of his job. But he lived in Killingbeck and would often visit his mother in Milgarth, the 2 areas highlighted by the algorithm. The partial print on its own hadn't been enough to identify him conclusively, but a subsequent DNA test proved that it was he who had committed these horrendous crimes. The police had their man. Barwell pleaded guilty in court in October 1999. The judge sentenced him to 8 back-to-back life sentences. Once it was all over, Rosmo had the chance to take stock of how well the algorithm had performed. It had never actually pinpointed Barwell by name, but it did highlight on a map the areas where the police should focus their attention. If the police had used the algorithm to prioritize their list of suspects on the basis of where each of them lived, checking the fingerprints and taking DNA swabs of each one in turn, there would have been no need to trouble anywhere near as many innocent people. They would have found Clive Barwell after searching only 3% of the area. This algorithm has certainly proved effective, and it brought other positives too. As it only prioritizes your existing list of suspects, it doesn't suffer from bias of the kind we met in the justice chapter. Also, it can't override good detective work, only make an investigation more efficient, so there's little chance of people putting too much trust in it. It's also incredibly flexible. Since Operation Lynx, it has been used by more than 350 crime-fighting agencies around the world, including the US Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And the insights it offers extend beyond crime. The algorithm has been used to identify stagnant water pools that mosquitoes use as breeding grounds, based on the locations of cases of malaria in Egypt. A PhD student of mine at University College London is currently using the algorithm in an attempt to predict the sites of bomb factories on the basis of the locations where improvised explosive devices are used. And one group of mathematicians in London have even used it to try and track down Banksy, the reclusive street artist, on the basis of where his paintings have been found. The kinds of crimes for which geoprofiling works best, serial rapes, murders and violent attacks, are fortunately rare. In reality, the vast majority of infractions don't warrant the kind of manhunt that the Clive Barwell case demanded. If algorithms were to make a difference in tackling crime beyond these extreme cases, they'd need a different geographical pattern to go on, one that could be applied to a city as a whole. One that could capture the patterns and rhythms of a street or a corner that every beat officer knows instinctively. Thankfully, Jack Maple had just the thing. Charts of the future. A lot of people would think twice about riding the New York City subway in the 1980s. It wasn't a nice place. Graffiti covered every surface, the cars stank of stale urine, and the platforms were rife with drug use, theft and robbery. Around 20 innocent people were murdered below ground every year, making it practically as dangerous a place as any in the world. It was against this backdrop that Jack Maple worked as a police officer. He had recently earned himself a promotion to transit lieutenant, and in his years in the force, he'd grown tired of only ever responding to crime rather than fighting to reduce it. Out of that frustration was born a brilliant idea. On 55 feet of wall space, I mapped every train station in New York City and every train, Maple told an interviewer in 1999. Then I used crayons to mark every violent crime, robbery and grand larceny that occurred. I mapped the solved versus the unsolved. They might not sound like much, but his maps, scrawled out on brown paper with crayons, became known as the charts of the future and were, at the time, revolutionary. It had never occurred to anyone to look at crimes in that way before. But the moment Maple stepped back to view an entire